And good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining the HITECH Annual Report Work Group. I'd like to welcome our co-chairs, Nadel Briggs-Melanson and Aaron Meary. And with us today is also one of our work group members, Eliel Oliveira. Brett Oliver and Stephen Lane and Jim Jurgis may be joining us shortly, but we can get started. Just want to note that public comments are always welcomed, which could be typed in the chat feature of Zoom or could be made verbally during the public comment period later in our meeting. And now let's turn it over to Nadel and Aaron, who will kick us off.
Thank you very much.
Go for it, Nadel. Start off.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. And thank you, Mike, for that wonderful introduction. And we're just going to go over very briefly of the agenda. Then I'm going to turn it to my co-chair to go over our next upcoming meetings. And then we'll dive deep into the continuation of our discussion of the crosswalk. So today, what we're really going to do is a continuation of our August 30th meeting, in which we're going to continue to discuss the topics that are going on the crosswalk for this year's annual report. And that should take up the majority of the hour. And then at approximately 10:55 Eastern time or 7:55 East Pacific time, we'll go ahead and start for public comment. So next slide. I'll turn that over to you, Aaron.
Absolutely. So what we're doing right now is obviously we had a July 28th meeting already done, the August 30th meeting already done. As Nadel mentioned today, we're continuing to go over the crosswalk all the way through until we officially submit to the HITECH December timeframe, and then with obviously approval sometime in the January, February timeframe and transmittal to the ONC national coordinator and onto the secretary sometime in the March, February timeframe. So that's how this goes. Next slide. Obviously for the full committee to review, we'll be reviewing with the full HITECH next week on the 14th and then sort of updates going forth on the 13th and the 10th of November. Usually the winter timeframe calls for a lot of email updates. We get some very verbose written comments from our HITECH members in the community, which we definitely take into consideration and look at it and try to finalize the report during that time. And of course, behind the scenes, you have the ONC team and the Excel team doing a great job, an audacious inquiry and others looking at topics and researching for us. So again, appreciate Michelle and all the efforts that go on behind the scenes on top of all the meetings that we just walked through. Next slide. All right, so next steps. Obviously, we've developed the draft crosswalk of topics. I see Dr. Jurgis has joined. Hi, Jim. We'll present the crosswalk for discussion at the HITECH on the 14th. Should be a good discussion, so we welcome all comments there and hope this committee will participate actively in that. And of course, we'll develop the crosswalk document during the fall and present brief updates to the HITECH as needed. So next slide. All right, so this is a draft crosswalk of topics. Again, sort of for the whole crosswalk, we'll go through it here just in a minute, but we want to consider the gaps, challenges, and opportunities and activities for sort of some additional target areas to discuss, which is the design and use of technologies to advance health equity, which we're all very passionate about. An additional target area, obviously, use of technologies for public health. As we know, the Public Health Task Force is meeting actively and doing some great work there. And of course, our priority target areas as established under 21st Century Cures, interoperability, privacy and security, and then our patient access to information. Next slide. All right, I think we're on the crosswalk now. Yeah, all right.
Yes, I think I think we are on the crosswalk. So yes, if our Excel team can bring that up. Thank you so much. And we had a very rich conversation during our August 30th a meeting to discuss all of these different areas. And so what we're going to do, we're going to move forward to where we actually stopped our previous discussion. So this here, you see a highlight of all of our new target area design and use of technologies that advance health equity. And if we continue to go on. We were also able to dive very extensively into the additional target area of use of technologies that support public health. Next page. And we were able to get to a fair amount of areas in interoperability. But the last topic that we did discuss was streamlining of health information exchange. which our proposed recommendation for HITACH was to hold a listening session to actually hear what many of the other federal groups are currently doing and really making sure that we can fill in some of those gaps in order to improve the capacity of the public health workforce in particular. And also we made that connection with also public or the overall health workforce for many different areas to advance not only public health, but also health equity. And so our next topic to really discuss is first starting with the interoperability standards, the priority uses, and especially as it pertains to closed loop referrals. And the reason why that this was brought up was that there's believed to be a lack of that cross-organizational support for closed loop referrals, including for social services. And so there is an opportunity to explore and advance various different standards that make sure that our systems do fully communicate with each other and are able to close any of the various different referrals, whether it's for healthcare services, public health services, or social services. So want to open it up to the committee to just receive some additional thoughts about this topic.
So Linda, I wanted to maybe suggest here that we are on the challenge here that it's not just the lack of standards, but the fact that we are talking about a variety of organizations now that do not even use, you know, electronic health records like we do in clinical practice, right? So that makes it very challenging to integrate, you know, closed loop referrals with social services organizations that can be of all types, all sizes, and different capacity of resources. So I think that might be something that to add on the challenges as well to consider.
Absolutely. Any other thoughts? Aaron or Jim?
No, I think I like the way it is right now. I agree with LEL's perspective. I need to see the research and literature behind it because there's so much work going on behind the scenes. So, you know, where are we as an industry right now? And I know that's what Michelle and team are working on to kind of get us information on that, but more to come.
And Jim, I saw you come off of mute as well.
Yeah, are you talking specifically about the closed loop referrals, Ro?
Right, we're talking about closed loop referrals, and then we're going to e-prior authorization.
I mean, I find it important on what comments you're looking for, but if we define what the data elements are for equity of quick care, for example, or social determinants of health, one of the tricks has been, okay, capturing that data is one thing, but the more we can also support standards to identify appropriate services through referrals and do that efficiently, the better, right? As a former primary care doc, you know, it was one thing collecting all this data. It was another knowing if there's any resources out there that could actually help you that you could refer that patient to, right? And so I endorse the way this is worded here, but I don't know how far we are from that reality, but it would
exactly.
Be-
Exactly, you said what I was saying, which is I know like CMS and others have been working on this for a while and the payers have been working on this for a while. AHIP had some initiatives around this. So I just don't know where the industry is right now in general, all those efforts. You're exactly right. There's been a lot of work going on for years on this topic.
But Aaron, I think part of these subcommittees and task forces is bringing people in to educate us on where it actually is. So it might be, you know, to me, it seems really important and it might be appropriate to get educated on where the state of the technology is or the option and advise ONC. But anyway.
Bingo.
Yeah, so therefore, it sounds like the overall recommendation is to assess where our current state is and where some potential gaps are so that then we can actually make informed recommendations. But it sounds like just assessing the current state and bringing in, again, all of the various different stakeholders to see where we have been and where our current progress is.
Right.
Great. Wonderful. And then, of course, LEL, exactly as you're mentioning, too, that way we'll be able to identify where those additional opportunities are. And so that goes directly into the next piece with e-prior authorization. And so once again, just looking at the lack of common standards and prior authorization across various different payers. And then really once again, thinking about what can we do for those opportunities to advance standards that improve our systems for prior auths, which we know is a really significant factor when it comes to access for patients across the country. And so those prior authorizations and the timeliness of those prior authorizations are critical in order to provide medical services. So any thoughts about this? I have a feeling it may be very similar to the previous one.
I would agree. What's interesting is I got through reading the book, The Big Fix by Dr. Vivian Lee, and she actually talks about this at length, ad nauseum, how this became such a challenge and where it came from. And so I think we've come a long way in all of that, but to the degree of it, you're right, Madel, this is still a big bugaboo. But again, a lot of work that's been done, just like closed loop referrals, I just don't know where the latest state of the industry is.
Well, hey, Aaron, I'd add to that. I think, isn't there an anticipated CMS rule coming out about prior auth and possibly another high-tech task force? So to me, it seemed like we identified the different data classes, data elements necessary for minimum viable product and beyond for e-prior auth. But many of those data elements didn't have semantic standards, et cetera, right?
Right.
So to me, it seems like a very high priority and important thing to similar to the one above it, figure out where we are and what next steps are and advise ONC.
Right. There was an effort. Yeah, there was an effort with Dr. Don Ruckert when he was ONC coordinator with CMS. And this is when we were meeting in person. So prior to COVID, we actually had a focused discussion on this. So one of our high tech meetings was turned all about this topic. And there was a lot of interest of collaboration and streamlining. And then a lot of the payers presented different ways they were trying to streamline and partnering with, you know, Change Healthcare and Availity and all these, you know, sort of brokerage and clearinghouses to partner. I know people like Epic Systems and others are trying to accelerate this. So there's a lot of work going on. So another summit would be great. I think we all learned the painful lessons of prior auth when we had to go all virtual for that time during COVID and realized, boy, this is a big bugaboo. So it's worth us talking about, in my opinion.
Yeah, so I was in the prior authorization task force, right, that we just completed a few months ago. There was a lot of work and it was very extensive, but it was also in a short time frame. And we had some great recommendations there. So it's either that those recommendations then are integrated into the report, or some additional work is done to revise those recommendations to then become part of the report. But again, quite a bit was already done just a few months ago.
Excellent. So once again, we really need to sort of collate all of that information together so that we can truly see where we currently are and then can proceed forward with some additional recommendations. This actually brings up the question and that we've actually had in some other meetings of some of these different items that we know are currently being focused on in other groups, subgroups, agencies, whatever that may be. Where is that intersection with HITECH? And is this something that we want to report out on in terms of the annual report? Or is this something that we put in the parking lot and we make sure that we receive information about where our current state is for these types of items? And then potentially even next year, actually make some additional more concrete recommendations for it once we have been more informed about where we currently are. So, you know, just bring in a conversation that has been had in other meetings to really make sure that the work that we continue to do is as impactful as possible. So last but not least on this page, standards for patient matching. And so this has always been a hot topic, especially since we've all transitioned to electronic health record systems and really trying to focus on interoperability and knowing the various different challenges of matching patients based off of their demographic information and their other personal identifiers. So really what this is focused on is how do we improve patient matching, especially when it comes to essentially our more vulnerable populations, and just really thinking about those opportunities of alignment and of incentives and certification programs across domains to encourage that ecosystem approach to improving patient matching. But I would also add thinking about the various different tools that are going to be universally accessible and helpful for not only the various different institutions, but also for patients themselves. Sometimes we think about it so much from the tech standpoint, we're not as patient-centered and we're not as provider-centered as what we should be. And so this is something for us to think about of how can we recommend those patient matching standards that is going to be highly inclusive and maybe even have some additional tiers. So that's one thing that I've always thought about when it comes to patient matching and making sure that we have more avenues. But love to hear what the three of you also feel about what we can think about proposed recommendations.
I think that there's been a lot of work recently that NIST has done. And so again, this is more research-wise for Michelle's team and others, I would like to learn more about. I've been seeing them put out a lot more revisions to the 800-53 and other standards around identity matching, identity proofing, and trying to get us to a very solid level of we can trust this identity with some fidelity that this is really Aaron, with some immutability around it. So I think there's some updates we can do in terms of where's the industry evolved to, where standards evolved to, and then technology-wise continues to evolve, although I'll be honest, it's still kind of the way it was always until there's some sort of national direction on this. But in terms of where we are, it's another one of those, let's seek first to understand where has the industry evolved to. I continue to hold my breath and hope, as I've been hoping for over a decade now, that we'll get here, maybe even more than that. But you know, we are evolving, so where are we, right? Biometrics, et cetera, et cetera. Jim?
So Aaron, one quick, I love what you're saying. I get the sense too that like somebody out there is point on driving to a standard that we can all agree people ought to utilize, right? But who is the primary owner of that? Is it NIST? Is it ONC director? Is it and what is TITAC's role, in that?
Yeah. No, great point. I think the way we've approached it in history, because this is a very understandably sensitive subject when it comes to patient privacy and others, we'll be very respectful, is more of the sort of conveyor of people in different authorities. We have had NIST present to us. We've had numerous different agencies come present to us over the years, including in the old days of the Health IT Policy Committee. This has been there. So to your point, Jim, I think this is where the ONC's really sweet spot of being coordinator, right? The air traffic control, lack of a better term, really comes into play of helping to bring people around this issue together to say, where can we go? Does HITAC have a say? I don't know. We'd ask that question, but I do say that we can definitely point at this as an issue plaguing healthcare and convening the right people together to talk about it.
The only thing I'd add to that, I completely agree. And I would add to that given where things are headed with TEFCA, FHIR, all that stuff coming into play, it is probably one of the most critical things to get right, because as different business entities and technologies interact with each other, identity management of forget providers for a minute, but of patients is so critical to avoid overlays or gaps in knowledge that I think it's a priority item. And in ONC's coordinating role, in addition to its standards role, it seems like it'd be a high priority to keep on the list.
I was going to say, I completely agree. It's an important priority to keep on the list. And I'm going to actually provide us some additional perspectives as well. So a lot of times when we have looked at standards, we have done some of the very basic identifiers, but we have not taken into account some of the nuances of patients themselves, whether it's going directly for providers or if we're talking about FHIR and APIs and all these other items for other non-provider entities when they're matching. And what's been occurring over time, even if you use various different methods like probabilistic matching and many other forms, in order to identify patients that may be in different systems, we have failed and we have consistently failed, especially for patients of various different backgrounds. For instance, they may actually have two last names, but yet we're only at trying to identify them on one name, and therefore you miss that. And so those are the types of, I believe, influence that we should be making sure that we're providing to all of these other entities that are trying to develop these standards. In addition to that, we've talked about the various conversation about biometrics, but again, biometrics can do wonders, but if we're not careful about even some of these additional ways of identifying patients, and especially because we do serve such a diversity of patients and communities, we can actually lead to, again, less trust for the system because of the type of biometrics we may be using, such as fingerprints or even retinal scans. So this is an area that I think that HITAC can have a large amount of influence of not only making sure that we have appropriate interoperability with the right algorithms, but that we're taking into account all of the various different needs of the patients that are currently right now within the nation, whether it's for clinical care or whether it's for other reasons.
You're exactly right, Madel. And real life story, we employ biometrics here. My organization, palm vein scanning, there are segments of the population who associate that with law enforcement.
100%. Who want
them to use that registration. Obviously, that's totally fine. We can register them the old fashioned way, right? It takes a little bit longer, but that's no problem. So we'd be very respectful. I think those all those inputs are very important for awareness. I emphatically agree with you coming from Adele. Great point.
I want to add a couple of thoughts on the first bullet, as far as, you know, just the matching itself. It might be interesting to look at other industries and maybe from there drive some standards for us to use in healthcare. I think the example that comes to mind is when you apply for life insurance or some other product online, and then they have to ask you some specific questions to validate who you are. You know, have you ever owned this type of car? Have you ever lived in this address? They have figured this out, right? To fully get out of the errors that could exist in matching someone. But we don't do that in healthcare. So there might be some exploration to be done in other industries where we can learn from and then derive standards that we can use. On the inability to link the identified data, I think that's where I think we need some standards as well. Through COVID, as you might be aware, the N3C, you know, NIH sponsored a large project to aggregate data to study COVID, took place and uses privacy-preserving record linkage solutions. And it works great. And FDA uses for their Sentinel network and others. National networks uses as well, but there isn't a defined standard, you know, that OMC or the standards body is basically saying this is what folks need to do when they are trying to link records without identifiers. So I posted the link here, the N3C, for you to look. But that needs some standards defined.
Agreed. Right? I mean, I say this way, you know, I always look at the U.S. military, the DOD, DHS as entities of expertise, right? And if DHS can do this with, you know, the fast pass and the clear lanes and all these things that and figure out a way to keep us secure, you know, flying and traveling in this country, surely we can employ some of those things. So maybe hearing from Homeland Security or hearing from DOD or hearing from other agencies, how they've tackled this with identity management, identity matching in a way that is uniform and works on a national scale, may be helpful to inform us on what are we not thinking about? Because they figured it out for Homeland Security. They're not perfect, but they figured it out. So how do we do this, you know, in a way that works? Because this is about patient safety, end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And I love what both of you all are saying is using other industries' best practices to see what we can actually do to inform healthcare. And so that's a great idea.
Do we know if, because the sense I got was that the people, you know, that's why I asked who's point on driving to a solution in the government, because my understanding is that people were looking at those newer other industry use cases to see how it could support it or not.
Yeah, we'd have to pull what the Congress's charge was. For a while, you got to realize there was a HHS was forbidden for a while. That has been removed or mitigated, was forbidden on investigating this until recently. Then they were commissioned to do a study. And then several continuing resolutions out of Congress alluded to, let's keep investigating this, let's get reports together. So ONC has done several studies. I think the last one was a year or two ago, if I recall, kind of where things are. I haven't heard if there's been a direction given to ONC that, you know, you guys are in charge of this. I don't know that answer. We have to investigate. But it seems to me, this is Aaron's personal opinion, that the industry has been kind of left to self-regulate this topic and sort of figure it out ourselves how we want to do this, but it's just leading everybody further waiting for someone to just tell us what to do. So I think that's why we need to convene and say, okay, where are we? So let's get this thing, you know, to a point of, okay, is it really going to be sort of free form, free for all, which Jim, I think you articulated that'll cause issues for TEFCA and others, or are we going to finally rally around some standard? I'm making this up totally, a biometric plus a password or a biometric plus your social security number or whatever that may be, right? Whatever that is, TBD.
Well, and one of the things, if we were keeping it on the list, one of the things for us to understand is, you know, who are the different government bodies working on it, and what is the path to actually moving the puck on actual use? Is it a CMS rule that where CMS uses its management of its programs to facilitate it? Is there something in certification? You know, how does the government coordinate getting to something that actually accomplishes the goal practically?
Yeah, the easy button would just say make it part of US CDI version 5, right? But that's the easy answer. Nothing is that easy. Well, so.
And I don't know that's the total answer, because it may define the standard, but we're evaluating all the CCDs we're receiving and the gaps in data fields. So there's going to have to also be some sort of incentive to use it.
That's right.
So we've had a wonderful conversation about this. I'm going to be the timekeeper since we have a few more topics to cover. But thank you for that. And I know our ONC team has captured all of this wonderful conversation and all these ideas. Obviously, this is a hot topic, as we discussed. Great. So we're going to move on to the next page as well.
And the last, Mandel,
I
think we skipped one. If you go
back.
Did we
skip one? Okay.
Yeah, the director.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes. Thank you for keeping me on track. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Directory standards and management. See, I was so eager to jump to the patient matching. So director standards and management. So this was actually proposed and we agreed to keep it on the crosswalk with really considering the struggles that healthcare providers in general, anyone in healthcare actually have with making sure that they have the digital contact in order to exchange information with other entities. And so the opportunity that was proposed here was, how do we improve the availability of electronic endpoints for all of our various different healthcare stakeholders? And so very interesting topic, and especially as we're talking about making sure that our links are much more solidified between all of us, for instance, and whether it's in healthcare, public health, as well as some of our, even our new vendors. So any additional thoughts about high-tech recommendations for this topic?
Now, I could have sworn, and I could be totally off here, I thought there was a CMS requirement to provide your information to a national directory by so date, like a January of 23 or 23.
There is, Aaron, but it was just a wall of shame. There's no penalty. It's on some website where it says whether you provided it or not.
Okay, that's all right.
Yeah. So shame may not be enough.
I was trying to think of the right word, but okay, we'll go with it. We'll go with shame. Okay, so there have been efforts. It just maybe hasn't taken adoption. I wonder why, right? It'd be interesting to hear if it's CMS or whomever tell us, boy, we wish we had a carrot and stick. I'm making that up, or whatever it takes.
Well, what I'd say as a provider, if the goals of 21st century cures, three of them are reduce provider burden, increase true interoperability, and increase patient access, right? The two areas that are huge burdens, staffing-wise or whatever, are prior auth and referrals, right? So to me, this seems critical, a critical piece if our future is going to be to use the national infrastructure to manage closed-loop referrals, then even knowing or even communications of content, then this seems to be a critical piece too. Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it seems like it's just more, our current opportunities are more than just making sure that every single one of the various different entities have a digital contact, but it's really how are we going to utilize that in the most efficient manner? And how is that truly integrated into some of our other workflows in order to decrease burnout, in order to increase access? So maybe this is a little bit too narrow. Maybe it is, yes, how do we ensure that those that we do have that accessibility of the digital content, but how will that information be used appropriately to address some of the other challenges that we're all currently facing?
Agreed with the appropriate. To me, it seems like getting people to use it appropriately has to first get people to actually use it, right? Mm-hmm. And if the data, so what I would say is the focus ought to be, okay, is there a service that allows someone to reach out for an NPI, for example, and understand what their HISP addresses are, for example. And I use the word plural, right? In order to have people be willing to use that, it has to be complete, it has to be accurate, it has to be standard enough to automate its use, right? And so, look at an OBGYN doc, they may have three HISP addresses. They may have their OB clinic, they may have a gynecologic clinic, and right? And so to me, getting into the details of what that should look like and how do we move from a wall of, instead of shame, a wall of compliance to actually having it be hardwired and reliable for people to actually use it. And I think that's going to be critically important in the future.
Well, for any of us who have done this, you know, all of us as practitioners, when your physician offices move and you can't even update Google with their new address, imagine trying to keep a directory up to date. If Google can't do it, then what are we missing here? So,
Aaron, in a past life at Vanderbilt, I was charged with developing a communication platform for all of our, what turned out to be 35,000 referring providers. And what we learned there is, because we tracked over many years, the address, at that point it was fax numbers, right?
Yeah.
But we tracked them, and we found out the significant number of doctors each year that actually change practices. And so that gets to bad data.
Right.
You know, it has to be kept up, and it has to be complete, and it has to be accurate, and it has to be machine understandable. Then people will use it as a service. Until then, if the data is really bad, which I know it is, and right, then getting to appropriate use, we can't even get there because no one will use it.
Right.
Yeah.
Great. So wonderful discussion again. And so it sounds like we have some recommendations for this topic as well moving forward. Now we have one last topic in interoperability, and then we still have two additional target areas to get to by the end of today. So use of telehealth, and this was something that we had, it was a more recent recommendation from our most from our high-tech full committee, and then making sure to bring it back here. And we actually put it directly underneath our interoperability, but knowing that it spans across just about every single priority area. And so the idea behind this was the unique interoperability considerations that exist for the equitable use of telehealth to help reduce the digital divide, with some of the various different opportunities of improving our bidirectional exchange of information between telehealth providers and the patient care team. And we already do have a few of those recommendations because we did discuss it, but just wanted to see if there's any other items we want to add. And so we had discussed last meeting to explore the benefits of encouraging that adoption of a true certified health IT platform by telehealth providers to ensure appropriate interoperability and bidirectional exchange of patient information and care plans. Any other additions we want to add to this topic?
Equitability. I mean, I think we've talked about it a number of times, but like for us, we serve a large rural portion of Florida and Georgia, and the inability for folks to access telehealth resources, it's even audio resources, which I thought was available everywhere, and it's not, especially for folks that are hard of hearing and have other ailments. It is amazing and sad the lack of ubiquitous access that people have to care, and it really does break my heart. So however we can include this, I think you were talking about that, Madel, into with health equity components and dimensionality, it's becoming more and more important. And leveraging things like social determinants of health, like patient-reported outcomes, other things to pick up on depression and other massive issues that are going on, then we've got to get away from just the episodic nature of telehealth into more comprehensive telehealth. But what does that look like, and how do we actually make this work? Because right now in its current state, it's a lights-on approach versus a tailored approach for respective groups so that folks feel supported and want to engage.
Absolutely. Can I agree with you?
Yeah, I agree. I would say the same experience here, Aaron, that we hear from folks that we are rolling out our mobile applications and doing some work. And what we hear from the most in need is like, well, I don't have minutes on my phone, so I can't use this thing. And when I recharge, I only have so much minutes to call my doctor to get a hold of somebody. So I'm not going to be able to use it. And that's real. And I'm surprised that we still hear at this stage that the ones most in need are the ones that are continuing suffering because they don't have access to basic technology assets.
Right. And we're talking about the three different domains of, for instance, telehealth and the digital divide. Number one, the characteristics of our patient population. Aaron, you brought up a perfect example of those that are hard of hearing, are those that may be also visually impaired. And then also, I would also say all preferred language, since still a lot of our telehealth platforms are still predominantly in English, although we know that there are hundreds of languages spoken in our country, especially Spanish being the most common now within our country after English. And then also, you know, Eliel, I agree with you in terms of just, you know, our devices and how we're developing these various different apps. And we're talking about device accessibility, as well as we're talking about just some of the economic aspects of device accessibility and who can actually use what. And then, of course, the third one is always just overall just accessibility of, while we always have mobile, still looking at Wi-Fi, looking at broadband, but then looking at also the literacy rates of using various different types of technology. So there's a lot in here that can be brought out. And that is something that we do when we're, if we're going to expand telehealth, we have to make sure we're not worsening situations and have it linked to outcomes. So I love what you said, Erin, about comprehensive care. There's been a lot of studies, even during the pandemic, how telehealth helped a lot of our aging population with feelings of social isolation in particular, and with depression, how telehealth, they literally checked in on them every single day, and their outcomes, both mental health outcomes and physical health outcomes, were significantly better in that aging population versus those that did not have those services. So a lot of area and room for growth and for impact here. Great. Any other items here for use of telehealth? I think we talked about a lot of great areas. All right, let's go on to the next page. Erin, I'm going to turn it on over to you for this next priority area.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. All right. Private security, which I love this topic. I always do. I don't know why. I just really like this stuff. All right. So first, alignment of innovation and regulation for consent directives, right? The gap, we know the pace of industry is innovation is faster than a regulatory environment for consent directives. Obviously, this also applies to research consent, which is very different than obviously patient care and treatment purpose consent. And you could sometimes have both or variation depending on what your IRB asks you to do. The challenge is the ability to exchange computable consent directives across health IT systems is limited. Actually, I would call it abysmal, but it is what it is. And then opportunities supporting the adoption of common standards to capture and exchange electronic consent directives. So, talking about patient consent and all the characteristics and permeations of consent, again, clinical and then research, and then sometimes just clinical trials and research, right? How does that work? What are we thinking here? And what do we think the industry is? I'll open it up by saying that I haven't seen much recent national efforts around consent standardization and alignment. I have seen languages proposed, like drafts that people could borrow for consent forms and whatnot, but you know, with also, I would also say with consent, if you look at pediatrics, there's also assent, right? We can't forget that. So what are we thinking? Open up to the floor. Madel, if you want to start, what some thoughts here?
Yeah, so for those of you all that know me well, my other real area is in innovation and really making sure that we're developing various different tools that not only help our patients and our communities, but of course also our providers and overall health. And it's interesting because I notice, I feel like this topic may have changed to really be a little bit more narrowly focused on consent directives versus I think some of our previous conversation were based off of the alignment of innovation and regulation in general, especially with the emergence of more FHIR apps and other type of APIs, and really seeing as more entrepreneurs and innovators come into the space that are creating all of these various different tools, how do we make sure they're aligned directly with the rest of our regulatory environment, and we're ensuring appropriate privacy, security, interoperability with some of our more healthcare-based systems as well. So that's just now, I didn't realize we were narrowing it down to just consent, but I would say that I think there definitely need to be standards. A lot of times, I think a lot of our innovation and our innovators are just thinking about something that's creative that they believe may actually work, but it may not have all of the various different pieces in it that we know that are required in order to protect our patients' privacy in general. So I'm just putting that out there, you know, especially for the committee. I think consent directives are great and that can be included, but I think there's a much larger ecosystem that we can talk about the alignment of emerging innovation and regulations when it comes to this area.
Great points.
Well, I'm thinking here that ONC did fund some pilots, right, to test out some consent, distributed consent systems. And I think that there hasn't been any push of like trying to maybe analyze this from a much larger level, something like Tafica, you know, and how QHIMS maybe be the places where consent, you know, stored and managed in some fashion. And I agree with Erin, like consent from clinical providers for care is one thing, consent directive is a different, and research is a completely different level. I still go back to my days of cancer research where, you know, data signed and the consents are for specimen usage and breaks down on who can use what your specimens for. And it's forgotten, right? It goes into a file cabinet. You know, the patient has never say again. And it's not the ideal setup. So I think maybe looking at what Tafica or QHINs would be able to leverage the network to be able to solve this might be an avenue.
Other thoughts? Okay. So I guess we got to learn some more is basically what we're summing it down to. Where are we with things and where is the industry going? All right, appropriate exchange and use of data. So obviously the gap is complying with the HIPAA minimum necessary standards, difficult without improved DS4P, data segmentation, and data segmentation for privacy capabilities. The challenges, there are currently no national adopted implementation guides for exchanging data for purposes of payment in healthcare operations. So the opportunity to promote the development and adoption of implementation guides to support improved data segmentation capabilities. I see this part and parcel personally with all the stuff that's been going on recently with some of these for-profit tech companies that have been having healthcare data sent to them, you know, inappropriately or inadvertently, EULAs that are, you know, pages and pages and pages long that nobody reads. And then, you know, what's that old saying that if a product is free, you are the product, right? Having people be aware of what their data is they're giving and opting in, particularly with maternal health, I think has been one that's front and center that a lot of companies have either advertently or inadvertently abused that, you know, privileged data. So there's a lot here around appropriate exchange and use of data. I know that the FTC and the OCR and others are doing a lot of work in this space. It'd be interesting to hear their take, but love to know what you all think. Jim, Aaron,
I had kind of a, I don't know if it's new, but I have kind of a new take on this area, right? And it goes back to our being, you know, my own organization being in 22 states, right? And so when you look at the appropriate exchange of information, some of that has to do with minimally necessary, right? And guidelines for payment and operations, but not all. Some of it has to do with the phrase that says that information blocking rules do not supplant HIPAA or local or state law. And our experience, as we try, you know, we have a patient portal, a single patient portal for our inpatient and outpatient areas, right? And what we have found is, even to understand what the laws are in 22 states, they're not like in one place. It might be the pharmacy board. It might be here. It's about $10,000 per state every time the attorneys look at it. And you have to keep repeating it, right? And the only reason I bring that up is because, you know, to me, it's ridiculous if we land in a place where every provider has to hire attorneys to keep track of what the state, what the applicable state and local laws are to adhere to. And I'm wondering if there's a role for private public partnership or something to help at least track that stuff so that people, we don't have to have all this additional burden. And so when I think of appropriate exchange, I think there's also these state laws that are, California is very different, right, than other states. And what we found is the language in the rule actually says that some who operate in multiple states may pick the state with the most restrictive and apply it to all. Well, it turns out it doesn't work that way. The things California doing are restrictive in a completely different way than the things other states are. So I guess what I'm wondering is, does ONC and HHS have a role in figuring out how to support people even knowing what the laws are in each state and how costly that is? Sort of a clearinghouse or something. What do you guys think when you hear that?
Interesting.
Yeah, you know, all interesting points. And I was just going to mention, I interpreted this also from thinking about how do we lessen burden and having some additional clear standards on what is not only going to be the minimum that is necessary, like back to the points that you two are making, but also what's going to be most practical. You know, back in the day when we first had our EHRs, we all talked about note bloat, where we have all of this excess information when we're, as physicians, when we're putting those various different notes in. But what is also just when we're exchanging information between all of our different facilities, what's just the minimal amount of information that's needed that can actually be actionable for us to care for our patients? And I'm not quite sure if we have those clear standards that have been defined yet throughout our country, but that may be also something to help decrease burden, to help improve healthcare. So that was just some of my thoughts about this topic as well.
Great points. Eliel?
Yeah, I was just going to, the thought that I had from Jean's comment was that, wondering the same, how have the financial services industry handled this across the states and not make so difficult? Is there a federal mandate that actually specifies how, and I know healthcare data is so much more complex than, you know, just money transactions, but it is pretty messy that every state you have to deal with so much more variation and not even know who to talk to get the approvals that you need. So anyways,
if only it was easy,
there are places to look at.
Yeah, if only it was as easy as signing your mortgage with a DocuSign, right? If only it was that easy. So.
Exactly.
Okay.
I think Aaron, and Manal, I think that ONC's role in reducing the burden on, in this case, providers, by understanding how burdensome and costly it is to even track the various state regulations, might be it fits with the 21st century theme of reducing provider burden. What could be done to make that, reduce the many to many costly problem?
Yeah. It would be interesting to hear what the work that's going on. And I think it's another listening session for us and learning, right? What's going on? I don't know. There was harmonization efforts that were going on even during Dr. Karen DeSalvo's time, right? They called a work group, I want to say in 16, of all the governors and the respective attorney generals, and figure out how do we get HIPAA and privacy and consent and data exchange all aligned across the state. So there's been efforts for years. I just don't know what the recent efforts are. So we just need to find that out. Okay, near and dear to all of our hearts, cybersecurity events across the healthcare infrastructure. And again, a time check here, we got to go to public comment here in a few minutes, but so we're gonna try to finish this section up. So cybersecurity events continue to increase. The challenges and skills and resources are outpacing the ability of professionals in healthcare to prevent cyber attacks, yes. And then opportunities offer guidance to the healthcare sector on ways to improve cybersecurity preparedness. I mean, there is a ton of work going on here with Section 405D and everything else, but love to know your thoughts on this, y'all. What can high tech do?
Encourage that work to continue.
Yeah. FBI does a really good job of doing NDHS. I know locally here in Jacksonville, we're very close partners with the FBI office. In fact, they're helping to run my simulation disaster next month, to be honest with you. So I was like, who better to run it for me than the FBI, right? Create a black swan event for us and tell us how to resolve it. And what do we screw up? So, I mean, it'd be interesting hearing from the FBI and DHS and others. What are you doing to prepare healthcare organizations? The resources they offer, by the way, that are paid for by our tax dollars are free and amazing. They'll do free pen tests for you, free tests of everything, because you paid for it already with your tax dollars. It's all via DHS. They have programs set up. So does the world know that? Should high tech help amplify that and partner with the FBI and DHS and others? Should we talk about what 405D is doing, which is great work there, that goes cross-sector, right? There's a lot of work here that we can do that I think we should, one, extract what the market is doing, and then two, publicize, if nothing else. What do you all think?
And yeah. I think that's a great idea as well, by the way. I think that's perfect to highlight that. So just wanted to say that, agree.
Perfect. Perfect, Adele. Jim?
Yeah, I was going to...
Or Eliel?
I was going to add, Aaron, that I keep thinking about the fact that, like, a few years back when I look at the OCR report of all the breaches, right, it was that... less than 7% were because of hacking. The great majority was because of social engineering. And that has changed recently. And I'm just wondering here, do we need to recommend a study of the situations that are causing the most breaches and attacks in healthcare organizations? Because I don't know, to be honest, it's a lot of data there on OCR. I have to look at those. But I don't have the time to analyze it all. But is small organizations more prone to be attacked? or larger one. So what is, you know, what are the different ways to look at that to kind of narrow down and figure out where the key issues are? Like the example I was giving that used to be hacking wasn't the major issue. It seems like that's growing, but why? So anyways, maybe learning more of what is taking place might help us advance this.
Good point. Good points. So more listening, more understanding then, because I'm hearing from the group. All right. And a time check here, we got 4 minutes for public comments. Let's see if we can get to the last bullet here. Privacy of sensitive healthcare data. Obviously, there's a lack of standards supporting segmentation of women's health data. We kind of talked about this in an earlier section, gender diverse populations, which I think we expanded upon at last discussion to make sure that we're being very inclusive. The challenges with the challenging legal landscape, you know, balancing protecting this need with making accessible concerns using gender information accurately and appropriately, offer patient matching and accounting to the patient, how sensitive their health data is being disclosed. The opportunity is obviously improving stakeholders' understanding of existing privacy protections, identify opportunities to improve technical operational. We've recommended a couple of activities. Let's see what we want to add to this, right? So encouraging the ONC to provide guidance on applicability of information blocking exceptions to the exchange of sensitive data. I think this is very important. And then two, suggest steps towards a consistent technical and operational approach, protecting sensitive health data while enabling exchange. Anything else that we should be thinking about? Other gaps? We talked about this last time, but other thoughts? Madel, I'll start with you.
Thanks, Aaron. I think the only thing that we may be missing here is, once again, how to use the appropriate information in clinical care. I had mentioned that previously, that especially as we continue to care for more gender diverse patients, that some of our algorithms directly in our electronic health record systems are not picking that up appropriately. And they can at times provide information or clinical decision rules that may be confusing or are not aligned with the providers and the patient's preferences. So I think that really, as we continue to, our world continues to change and we are more inclusive and people are being their more authentic selves, making sure that we are incorporating that information appropriately into our clinical algorithms and clinical decision tools that are built within our health IT systems. So those types of standards. And I'm not quite sure if the Gender Harmony project is actually working on these entities, but I think that's something that's really important for us to discuss and explore.
Great point. I hadn't thought about that. Great point, Madel. Love it. Jim, Eliel?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I think it's incredibly important too. And but is it an appropriate example of what you're talking about that, you know, for example, somebody treating a patient whose birth gender, birth sex or whatever was male, but are identifying and even have had some work that you've done to an estrogen therapy, et cetera, and now prefers the she, he, her. But in the course of care, the doctor needs to make medical decisions based on the fact that there's a prostate, and it could be a prostate cancer or screening, how to do that while still respecting the individual's desire to be identified as a woman. And I don't think the informatics is as hard as the actual culture issues there, because you get the representation of collecting a birth sex and then where people are in their journey to their authentic self, right? I don't think, you know, us defining the field that we ought to, ONC ought to absolutely facilitate that, right? But the trick comes with, you know, the front desk person who, you know, might have been working at McDonald's yesterday and now is over here, how they actually interact, and people are skeptical. They don't want to even go there and ask the question. So completeness, bad data, let alone how a skillful doctor or nurse interacts with the patient. Those are the challenges, it seems.
Yes. Right. So Jim, that's there right. are some technical, and Aaron, I know we're at public comment, right. but there are some technical aspects that I can give you real life examples for my institution that we had to address. But Aaron, I know we're at public comment right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, let's go to public comment, and Eliel, let me make sure we get your comments too over time, okay? So sorry to cut you off here. Mike, can we go to public comment, please?
Yep, we sure can. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause for a moment to see if anyone raises their hand. Not seeing any hands raised, Madel and Aaron, so I'll turn it back to you.
Perfect. Sorry, Madel, to cut you off, and sorry, Ellie, I made a comment. Mm-hmm. Madel, please back
no
to
problem.
You.
No problem. I'll spend only 30 seconds. Real life example, my institution is a center for gender health excellence. So we actually do make sure that we are providing comprehensive affirming care, as well as everything from hormone treatments to also sex reassignment surgeries. So there's normally three primary areas within an EHR where you record the sex and gender identity, your legal sex, of course, your sex assigned at birth, and your gender identity. If any of those areas are not filled out appropriately, there are various different algorithms, especially in our EHRs like Epic and Cerner, that it can actually lead to erroneous lab values. For instance, if your sex assigned at birth is not there, but yet, and maybe you don't have a legal sex, but you only have gender identity, or you have one or the other. So depending on the completeness of those fields, what may occur is that you may be given more of a narrow lab value for different forms of screening tests, which may seem that you have an abnormal result, which will then lead to potential overuse or overtreatment. But then also in addition, what can occur is back what you're saying, Jim, in terms of preventative screening. So for instance, let's say you are assigned a female at birth, but now your gender identity, you actually identify yourself as non-binary or even as a trans man, you still may have your organs, your biologic organs, which still means that you do need to be screened appropriately for, you know, cervical screenings, many other types. So that's just something for us to think about as we're caring for more gender diverse populations.
Great point, Madel. Eliel, your turn.
Yeah, I have two quick ones. One is there a consideration that this becomes part of the elements protected under HIPAA, because it's not even part of the 18 elements, right, that are considered PHI? And the second one is, in some of our projects here, when we're collecting data using the new standards, using FHIR and USCDI, they are very different than what's captured by EHRs and by Health Information Exchange, meaning we're not able to match anybody. So I agree with Jim that there may be a collection or storage of these pieces of information on gender for two different purposes. And at this point, I don't know how would even fix the EHRs and exchanges to be able to link data if the standards like FHIR or USCDI do not match them. It's a part of the algorithms of matching to use gender.
Yeah, and you know, something linking us back to the past, we have proposed, as suggested, items for further investigation, some sort of application clearinghouse. I'm loosely going to call it like a Better Business Bureau for health apps, right? Is it the FTC? Is it the ONC? Is there some sort of chapel that's set up like the ONC has for health IT certified products that show bad actors, good actors? Because even at that, if you were to download a consumer app, it could be written in some country with loose data law jurisdiction, or you know, it falls out of HIPAA, like genomic data, like 23andMe falls out of HIPAA, right? HIPAA does not protect you if you give your genomic data to 23andMe and similar companies. So how do we warn people, like a Better Business Bureau, lack of a better term, that your privacy of your data is at risk, right? So that if you do want to be respected, as we should all, and receive care appropriately and information appropriately, that your data is not going to be misused or used against you for that point. I don't know of a clearinghouse like that. It's sort of left to the wild, wild west, but FTC and others are trying to tackle this. FDA is trying to tackle this. So maybe we listen also to what the other agencies are doing, similar to what we did before, and say, how are you all contemplating this? Because right now it's falling on the providers and the physicians to have to explain to the poor patients, hey, that app you downloaded that tells you this thing was really written from a country that you really don't want to be sharing your data with. So I don't expect physicians to know that. That's not fair. So how do we do this and make it a very democratized, open way and transparent way? Those are conversations we should have and consider having with other agencies and say, what are you guys doing? So we can bring attention to this. All right. That was enough of me on a soapbox. We are at time. Madel, anything you want to say to close? We're going to close this out.
Yeah, no, this has been a wonderful, great discussion, like always, and really appreciate all the various different feedback and also all of the ideas. So we appreciate all of you all.
Great conversation. Thank you all. ONC team, thank you as every time. Appreciate you. Mike, Michelle, thanks.
Thank you.
You are welcome. Glad to help.
Thanks, everybody.
All right. Bye, y'all. Talk soon.
Bye.